Hey, Joe, thank you so much. That was great. Love that. You too, Chris. Dang. Yeah. Yeah, all right. Yeah. So here we are again. It's a Sunday. And I'm going to start with one of my favorite Ernest Holmes quotes. Some of you are probably familiar with it. But Ernest Holmes, who is the founder of this denomination, wrote that we are bound because we are first free. And what he means by that is that we have spiritual laws to work with. We're free to use them for constructive or destructive ways. And that freedom allows us, we're so free that we can even bind ourselves with the destructive use of law. You know, a really good example that's coming up for a lot of people right now is the internet. You know, if you've seen that show, The Social Dilemma, that movie, you can see that the internet was started with really good intentions, and there are some folks that are using it with intentions to destroy or to hurt other people and what have you. So that's just the way a lot of spiritual energy is in this world. So I love that quote about how we are bound because we are first free, but I also love to flip things. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I love to flip things. And is it possible that we are free because we are bound, that being bound gives us more freedom? I'll let you ponder that for a little bit, and then I'll get back to it. The featured book this week, or this month rather, is called The Great Work of Your Life by Stephen Cope, and I've been going over kind of the basic premise of it every week, so I'll just give a very, very short Cliff Note version of what it's about. It's about the Bhagavad Gita, and the basic story of the Bhagavad Gita is that Arjuna, who is this real, like, tough, handsome young dude, kind of like if you want to look at Spartacus up there, that might be a good kind of representation of Arjuna. I don't think he had a mask on his sword, but still, it was a different time back then. So he's this kind of tough dude, and then he is supposed to do his dharma, his sacred calling, which is fight in a just war. And instead of being all excited about his dharma, he is like many of us, when we get our spiritual calling, we doubt whether we can do it. We doubt whether or not we're good enough or whether the resources will apply or show up when we need them. And so he is cowering in fear on the floor of his chariot, and then enter Krishna, who is his charioteer, but it's really God in disguise, and he gives him a lesson on dharma, four pillars of dharma. Last week, we spoke about dharma, and again, dharma is sacred calling. We talked about claiming your dharma, knowing that if you're here in a body, you have a dharma. Just like everybody has a fingerprint, you have a specific dharma fingerprint. So no more dharma denying. Everybody has one. It's just our job to seek it out and find what it is. And then the second pillar of dharma is to live your dharma fully. The prophet Dolly Parton said it well when she said, "Find out who you are and then do it on purpose." So those are the first two pillars of dharma. Find out who you are, what you're supposed to be doing with your life. In fact, what does spirit want to do for you, with your life, for yourself and also for the service of others? Because when the service of others intersects with your personal power, then things go viral. Ooh, I don't know if I can say viral. Is that a good thing? Things go really good. and then do it on purpose. Now, what does doing it on purpose mean? Well, according to Stephen Cope, doing our dharma on purpose is a lot like doing a yoga pose. So in yoga, and I will not be giving a yoga demo, by the way, yoga does not do well for me. I don't have the personality for it. I'm too aggressive and too demanding of myself, and I compare myself to others. Okay, that was my confessional. But I've heard in yoga that many of the elaborate poses align around the spine. All of your various parts of your body align around the spine so you can stay in balance. And Stephen Cope, the author of this book, likened that unto dharma, that dharma is like our spine, and all of our being, all of our doing, all of our thoughts, all of our words, all of our actions are supposed to align around our dharma, the spine of our dharma, the spine of our sacred calling. And I don't know, when I look at my life, I say, okay, some of my words and my actions and my being and my doing are aligning around my dharma, what I feel is my sacred calling, but not everything, not everything. So today is about kind of looking at that in a kind and compassionate manner and saying, wow, we are really here to live on purpose. And what can we do to step up our entry into that purpose, to do our purpose on purpose, and to live like the truth of our Dharma is really true? Because face it, many of us, when we are posed with a new condition or something that we're called to do, we wind up like Arjuna cowering on the floor of our metaphorical chariot. So, back to that quote by Ernest Holmes, we are bound because we're first free, but are we free because we're first bound? And I would say yes. If we bind ourselves to Dharma, and Dharma is another word for love, in case you don't feel like you have a word of Dharma, if we bind ourselves to love, that gives us immense freedom. And it's not only our immense freedom, it is the freedom of the divine. We harness the heavens when we bind ourselves to our Dharma and live on purpose as if the truth of our Dharma was really, truly our sacred calling. So, in this book, Stephen Cope gives lots of examples of people living in the spirit of Dharma, people doing what they're called to do, and a few of people doing what they're not called to do, doing the opposite of their Dharma and getting leading sad, depressing lives because of it, or lives that are not as full as they would like them to be. When I was reading this book, though, one word that came up for me a lot, and it's not a popular word in Science of Mind teachings, a word that came up for me a lot when I was reading this book was sacrifice. Now again, some people think that's a bad word, that we shouldn't sacrifice anything, but really it's a beautiful word because it means to make sacred, to sanctify our lives by aligning everything around that spine of Dharma. One of the things that is helpful about sacrifice, one of the things that was brought up in the book, was that when we are really aligning with our Dharma, when we are making sacrifices, sometimes the sacrifice is to say no to things that don't serve our highest purpose. Anybody here struggle with saying no sometimes? Okay. I had a feeling. Had a feeling that was true. And if you're in our virtual congregation, please feel free to type the words, "I confess, I have trouble with saying no." I confess, I have trouble with saying no. I just want to do everything all the time. And sometimes it comes from a healthy place of joy, of engagement, and sometimes it comes from a place of people-pleasing or needless obligation. I read an article about women writers one time, several years ago, and one of the things, it struck me in terms of this conversation about the difficulty of saying no, because one of the things that they said about women writers in particular, it may be true for men as well, but this was an article specifically designed to reach women writers. And it said that so many women put off writing a book or writing for themselves or writing to be published because they can't do it until everybody in the household is taken care of. They can't do it until the dishes are washed. They can't do it until the hair is out of the shower drain. You know, when you're trying to write, you come up with all these excuses, all of these reasons not to write. And that is so true for anything that is a dharmic calling. We often wait until conditions are right before we step into our Dharma. And what if we could just step into our Dharma knowing that the conditions are not right, knowing that the conditions may not support us, but like that reading said, as soon as we take the step, boldness rushes in and genius rushes in and things appear from out of nowhere that lift us into a greater place of acceptance and love and practice of our Dharma. So we have to stop waiting for conditions to be right in order to practice our sacred calling. It isn't always about physical things either, like physical things like writing or doing in the world. Sometimes it's the way we are choosing to be in the world. You know, one of my dharmic callings is about living in the world of non-duality. I just am fascinated by non-dual consciousness and realizing that we're all awareness and that we're all one and we're all whole and we all share fingerprints and blood and enzymes and all kinds of beautiful things that we share with the earth, you know, all of this stuff. I'm just fascinated by that, and I want to live in this non-dualistic consciousness. And yet, I don't always want to give up speaking from a dualistic point of view, which in my case, that means complaining. And there's that thing about conditions being right. It's like, how are you going to stop complaining when there's a whole pandemic going on and the world seems completely cuckoo right now, and there's that election process happening, and there's all kinds of things happening, not only in America, but all over the world that are distressing. How are you going to stop complaining at that time? That is the perfect time to stop complaining. But I haven't quite figured that out yet. So I decided to stop complaining about one thing. One thing. And that was, okay, we're going to be hearing from the choir today. Sorry. And when we do a virtual choir, we have to record our own voices individually. And it is, okay, I'm going to complain for a minute. It is torture. It is so hard. It is torture. And I realized that I was doing a lot of complaining about it and also kind of enjoying the comedy of it, the drama of it, you know. And then I realized, you know, just give me a bigger picture about this. And I realized that I'm working hard to do this, but there are other people that are working even harder to keep the choir together and to fill this need for our congregation, the choir director, Mary, and David, her husband, and John Johnson, who mixes everything. And so I just decided that the last thing we record, I wasn't going to complain about it. And what I discovered, you know, it's amazing. We look for the little gifts and things. I discovered that when I don't complain about stuff, like recording a choir piece, I don't have to do it 20 times. I can usually get it done in one or two takes. And the deeper realization for that is this old adage that I've heard for a while, but I hadn't thought of it until I engaged in that practice of not complaining about having to record a choir song. And that was that perfection is often the enemy of enough. And what that means is that if you're striving for perfection, 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 you may never get anything done. And really what you're doing is already enough. So I would listen to my thing that I recorded and say, you know, I don't really like the final consonant on that. I need to do it again. And then I do it again and the dog would bark and that would be over, you know. But it's just, the point is, it's not about, you know, me transcending this the allure to complain. It's more about all of us. It's about all of us looking at, can you just change one thing in your mind, in your consciousness? Just pick something small. If giving away something big, letting go of something big, sacrificing something big feels like too much, pick something small and then be hyper-vigilant for the gifts that it has to offer, because I promise you, it will offer you gifts. There's a great lesson that I learned from the choir. Thank you very much. Another thing that we are called to sacrifice when we are pursuing our dharma is our perception of what the world needs to be, what the world is, and the limitations of our own perspectives about what we can accomplish within the world. You know, one of the examples that Stephen Cope gives in his book is Susan B. Anthony. And I think probably most of us know who Susan B. Anthony is. She was an advocate for women's rights, and she got the vote for women. And when you look at the times in the book, it was really fascinating to read about the times that she grew up in, because it was impossible for women. There was just this consciousness that put into law all of these things that were in place to suppress women's rights, such as that the woman is the property of the husband. Go figure. You know, and it gave me a lot of insight as to what's happening now with racism, about all these things that people take for granted that are part of systemic racism, and then, you know, the willingness to look at that and do things a little bit differently, to change the conditions by changing our perception and our consciousness of the conditions. Like, does this really have to be? Does this really have to be? And she was a Quaker, and she was shy, and she was retiring, and she had no interest in public speaking. However, she just knew that she was supposed to do this. She knew that she was supposed to change the world for women. And so she did. And she got a public speaking coach, and she dressed according to her dharma. She loved bright colors, but she didn't want her colors, her dresses, her outfits to be a distraction. So she wore mostly blue and black, very plain clothes. And she spoke, and she spoke, and she spoke, and she spoke, and she changed the world for women. And One of the things that I really loved about her was that she did it in a kind and a polite and a compassionate manner. It said that she was unflappable, that she would rarely, if I think at the beginning she might have like stormed out in a rage occasionally, but as she got more sophisticated with it, she just would have a sense of humor about all of the attacks that she was getting and just able to just hold all of that and continue moving forward in service of her Dharma. She was asked, when do you pray or do you pray? And she said, my whole life is prayer. Everything I do in the service of my sacred calling is prayer. Even the clothes I wear are prayer. So I just thought that was so beautiful, that she was able to sacrifice the consciousness of the day, of the times, and listen to the callings of the times, which is what we talked about last week, and then step into greater expression of her Dharma. I have a personal example of that from one of my friends. I had the pleasure of speaking with my friend Anna, who lives in the Philippines. I met her in India, but she lives in the Philippines, and she was... She was an actress in New York for quite a while, and she's Filipino. And then she moved back to her homeland and started teaching acting, and also had a prison ministry for a while, teaching acting. In fact, she still does, but everything's different now because of the pandemic. And so when the pandemic started, you know, the world for actors is not really conducive right now to fulfilling that destiny. So everything changed, and she found that she didn't have as much to do. But she really, really wanted to serve. And one of the things that happened with her is that she recognized that the Philippines is a very impoverished country. There are a lot of people there that are starving and suffering, and there's a lot of need there. And so she contacted one of her neighbors who has a chicken farm, and she ended up talking with him just in a conversation. He mentioned that every week he discards about 400 eggs that break. He said, there's nothing we can do. We can't sell them because they're broken eggs. And she suggested, why don't you take the egg ingredients, the yolk and the white, and put it in a plastic bag, and we'll freeze them, and then we can make them into scrambled eggs. And so she did. And then her sister, Anna's sister, talked to another chicken farmer who had 600 eggs a week that he was discarding because they were broken. And so now they have about 1,000 eggs a week that they are able to scramble and cook up and throw in some other donated food. And they are feeding so many people because they were called to serve, and they responded to the signs of the times, and they were willing to be flexible, and they were willing to do what their Dharma instructed them to do in the moment. Even if it didn't seem like their plan, they knew it was a plan to follow because it was coming from a higher source. And so I invite all of you, what is calling you? Is there something that is calling you, something that you feel that you want to do, and you're allowing yourself to push it aside because it either doesn't make any sense, or it doesn't fit in with the times, or it doesn't fit in with who you think you are, like Susan B. Anthony or my friend Anna? What is calling you, and can you take that leap into greatness? And if it brings you a little bit of fear, that's not a problem. And if it brings you a lot of joy, that's not a problem either. I run into people all the time who are a little embarrassed because their Dharma feels like it's supposed to be about spreading happiness and joy or self-care. If that's your Dharma, then that's your Dharma, because the world needs that as well as people who are engaging in service in more traditional manners. So listen to your Dharma. See what it is you might need to let go of, the opinions of others, the shoulds, the conventions of what has always been done, and then see if you can just take a small step into that place of expressing your true purpose, your true calling. It's a beautiful thing. Another really wonderful thing that we sacrifice is our attachment to the laws of the material world. Those of you who are taking my Rumi's field class, which is amazing, by the way, it's really wonderful. We're going deep and it's beautiful. I feel so blessed to be teaching that class at this time. Could talk about Dharma, right? But anyway, it's a beautiful class, and I've been really obsessed with this Cynthia Bourgeau quote about another word that we don't say very much in religious science, martyrdom. We don't talk a lot about sacrifice. We don't talk a lot about martyrdom. And Cynthia Bourgeau says that martyrdom is a word that has been misused. And what she says, she's very, very intellectual. So I did martyrdom for dummies here because that's the way I can understand it. She says that martyrdom is to live in the laws, beyond the laws of ego. laws of higher causality, compassion, and intelligence. Martyrdom is to live out of these laws flawlessly so that you create an energy center around them that others can gravitate around. And, you know, the martyr, you're sacrificing your ego for all of this, right? You live in this energy so others can gravitate around this energy. And there we find reconnection with the actual source of abundance in this planet. This source participates holographically in the divine heart. And what that means to me is that a hologram, you see little microcosms of what you see everywhere. And so if we have this holographic heart and we're focusing on love, we start to see love and the gift everywhere. We as a people draw our strength from the whole and the holographic heart, by the way. Wholeness reassembles back into the world as new resources of collective compassion, courage, hope, and joy. And one of the ways to do this, really, I know that's it's still a little confusing, and that is a quote that I think is something that bears a lot of meditation and a lot of looking at, and a lot of application to our own lives. But the gist of it is to live outside of the laws of this world, to live away from the laws of the ego. And we're all familiar with the laws of the ego, I think, you know? Instead of love your enemies, slap your enemies, right? Instead of bless those who curse you, curse those who bless you. That's one that doesn't really flip very well, okay? Whereas the opposite of what I just said, love your enemies, which is the teaching of the Master Jesus, and bless those who curse you, those are laws of the higher world. And what would life be like if we decided to live in those laws versus our knee-jerk reaction to start cursing everybody who seems to cross our path? And have you noticed a lot of people seem to be crossing us these days? Just go on Facebook. Just go on the news. Just talk to somebody who thinks differently than you. There's a lot of opportunities to love our alleged enemies and to bless those who seem to curse us, all right? I, again, had a bit of an India reunion with a friend of mine that I know. He lives in Turkey, and he's been inviting me to read a blog post that he has, and wants me to help circulate his work. So I told him if he told this particular story in a blog, I would circulate it, which I will on Thursday. His name is Marian. He lives in Istanbul, Turkey. His wife is Aslinor. They are an unusual couple. He's a German Protestant. She is a Muslim woman. She studies Islam, and she's getting a master's degree in the poetry of Rumi and other mystical poets. He decided that he was tired of the regular news stream, and so he decided to start writing sacred journalism, where he focuses on spiritual principles. Really remarkable couple. And they told me a story a while ago that I think I've shared here, but it bears sharing again because it's such an example of living outside of the world, the laws of the ego. That they were in this mosque with a group of people that they were leading a tour. They were in this mosque, and they wandered around the mosque for a while. Most of the people were, I would say, Americans. And then they sat in a circle to process their experience of the mosque. And while they were in this circle, two men from Turkey, Muslim men, came and sat very close to them. This was before the pandemic, sat very close to them and started loudly criticizing them in Turkish. And nobody in the circle could understand what they were saying, but they felt this animosity coming towards them. And they were saying things, you know, like these stupid tourists, they don't know anything, they're just like, glomming onto our tradition and saying all kinds of bad stuff, probably worse stuff than that. Well, my friend Aslinor, the woman of this couple, is Turkish and she speaks it very well. And so she could hear exactly what they were saying. Now, I've had situations in my life where I feel like somebody is intruding on my right to be or my right to express what I want to express. And I don't always love those enemies, and I don't always bless them. But Aslinor did. She turned around and she smiled at them with a big smile, and she's also gorgeous, by the way, which helps. But anyway, she turned around and smiled at them with a big smile and said, you know, I'm Muslim, and I'm telling them all about Islam, and we would love to hear from you guys too. And so she invited them into the circle. She called them in versus calling them out and shaming them and punishing them for being, you know, being unkind. She called them into the circle, and gradually, bit by bit, people started asking them questions. Things like, well, what do you love about your religion? And what was your first experience in the mosque? Can you tell me something really special that you've learned from your religion? And these people that were potential enemies became friends. And so that's what I'm talking about in terms of living outside of the laws of this world, moving into the higher spiritual laws, is be willing to be paradoxical, be willing to sacrifice our need to be right, be willing to do the uncommon thing of calling people in versus calling people out, be willing to do the strangeness of getting to know people who you think are against you, the willingness to see the humanity of anybody that seems different than you, the willingness to even have the courage to have that conversation. Those are bold statements of Dharma, particularly if your Dharma is to love, particularly if your Dharma is to serve, particularly if your Dharma is to bring greater hope and healing to the planet. Those are simple things that you can do that are readily available right now. Thank you, God, for sending us so many opportunities to practice. And that's what it is, folks. It simply is practice. It's practice every day, every breath, whenever we can remember. Remembering is half the job, you know, just remembering, oh yes, I'm supposed to be on purpose here. What would someone on purpose do in this moment? Do I want to do it? No. Well, maybe you could do it anyway. Try that. And what happens is that you start seeing the gifts of living in your Dharma everywhere. It's that fractal, holographic, universal thing that Cynthia Bourgeau was talking about. If your Dharma is to bring love, you take the love that is within you and you start seeing that the love was there all along and that you are part of bringing it out into greater consciousness, into greater knowing. If the Dharma is to bring about healing, you start to see opportunities for healing everywhere. We look for the gift in everything that happens to us. And ultimately, we start to recognize that we are the gift. Our Dharma is a gift that is priceless. And so we live from that knowing, and everything changes. Let's do that now, and let us pray.